Hello, my name is Brian McKenna. I'm one of the editors at Computer Weekly, and I'm here to bid you a very warm welcome indeed to the Computer Weekly
Downtime Upload
podcast.
And those two other voices were?
I'm Caroline Donnelly, I'm a senior editor at Computer Weekly.
And I'm Alex Croxton, I'm networking editor at Computer Weekly.
And Alex is also standing in for Claire McDonald, who is at this very moment probably wending her way home from Heathrow, having been at Sweet World in Vegas,
yeah.
I believe.
Mm-hmm.
And we'll be back with us next week, but should be far too jet-lagged and or in transit. And we have Alex, who this is her third appearance on the podcast.
Yeah, I think so. Must be about that by now. I've not been travelling particularly far this week. I only got as far as Hackney.
And
I've got no stories of Barcelona this time around.
But Alex is going to be talking about peregrinations around the capital, in particular a visit to a conference on social inclusion. Also in today's podcast, on the travel theme, Caroline's going to talk a bit about her visit to Google Cloud Next.
Yep, in San Francisco.
I have been travelling this week, and I'm going to say a few things about my trip to Amsterdam to Inforce Conference in Spire. We're going to begin by reflecting back on a story that we covered last week in last week's podcast about Meg Lynch, the doyen of late 90s British IT, you know, CEO and founder of Autonomy, Caroline.
Yes, the HP versus Mike Lynch trial is going from strength to strength at the moment in the High Court. It's predicted it's going to run for 9 months, so I think there's going to be a lot more to say on this as time goes by. Yeah, I think there's a lot to unpick. So obviously, the crux of the trial is they're trying to get to the bottom of whether or not HP overpaid for Autonomy when they bought them in 2011.
Yeah.
Because there was some kind of cooking of the books going on at Autonomy. So they bought them for over 11 billion, and then they ended up having to write off 8.8 billion, I think, of the purchase just a year later because of all this. So last week on the podcast, we pondered the question, how does something like this happen? Like, surely someone with HP's money, they must have the money to pay for lawyers who can do lots of due diligence and that kind of thing. And we found out this week from the High Court, from what's played out, that they did, in fact, pay for due diligence. They got KPMG to write a draft report into its findings into it. But it turned out that HP's CEO at the time, Leo Apotheker, didn't read it. So they did the due diligence, as we asked the question, it just didn't get read. And it also emerged that he didn't read any of Autonomy's most up-to-date financial results at the time of the purchase as well. That he used to hire people who would tell him whether or not, he would look at all that stuff for him and then tell him if there was anything to worry about. So the Downtime Upload, we chucked this question out to the universe, and it responded within a matter of days through the events that played out in the world of tech.
And a very experienced enterprise software executive there, ex-SAP.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
I think there's going to be more revelations just coming out because, well, this trial, and there's been other ones in the US, have kind of opened a bit of a door into what the work environment was like at HP around the time of the acquisition. So it sounds, as an independent observer, kind of toxic. You know, people being like there's been this war of words apparently between Leo and the ex-CFO at HP. They weren't really on the greatest working relationship. You know, people being shut out of meetings so that, you know, things around the acquisition get pushed through. It all sounds a bit Brexit-y to me.
Yeah.
Leo left under a bit of a cloud as well.
Yeah,
if I remember rightly.
Yeah, he left 2 months before the Autonomy purchase actually got signed off as well. So, yeah, so I think there's lots more interesting stuff to come. But yeah, like I say, we asked a question and we found out, so I think we need, in future, maybe more questions we should ask on the podcast and then see if we get a response within a week.
And with a bit of luck, people will do our homework for us.
Yeah, that'd be great. Less preparation for us.
So this week's issue of the e-zine that's been signed off now, one of the big case studies in this issue is one of yours, Caroline.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
ASL Airlines.
Yeah, pan-European sort of freight and passenger airline. So they actually won the Best of Show award at the VMworld Awards, which Computer Weekly is a long-standing media partner of, last year. But the reason why it seemed to win over the judges, this story, is I think because it shined a really interesting light on some of the threats that the aviation industry are under at the moment. So there was, in their case, they were saying that they face up to at least one ransomware attack a month. And I don't know, at the time I was kind
and
of
these
wrong.
Are threats not from Boeing?
Well, who knows? Well, who knows what the motivation is, really, for hackers and people like that? You know, taking down an airline or sort of grounding all their flights and everything is a very dramatic, very public, kind of bit of disruption that they can cause. And if you're looking for kudos and all that kind of stuff in what you're doing, it's kind of like, hey, look what we did. We grounded all these flights. We wiped, you know, X millions of pounds off this company share price by rendering them unable to operate, which is. It kind of draws some parallels with the British Airways downtime incident, which wasn't hackers, but it was a data centre incident, and it caused mass disruption. The case study itself just takes us through the work that they've been doing just to make sure that if, you know, something like that were to happen, either cybersecurity related or kind of some other kind of IT outage, but they are, their IT backbone, if you like, is resilient and they can just bounce back from any of that. So I don't want to go into too much detail because that's why we wrote the case study, and I want you all to go and read it in the evening. So this company itself, they have 3.2 million passengers that they transport every year, over 565,000 tons of freight as well. So yeah, if none of that can fly, you're looking at big compensation claims from the people who need those deliveries.
Are they mainly a freight operator?
Primarily, but yeah, they do some passenger stuff. So the other thing they were saying as well is that because the aviation industry is so highly regulated, if there's any kind of downtime because they're not taking off at the right time, so that they can get fines and things like that. But they're basically saying they've taken kind of an iterative approach to refining their data backup procedures over many, many years. And now that has got them to a place where they back up all their data, not just to two data centres, but to two clouds as well, with the help of technology firm Rubrik and their cloud backup system.
Yeah.
And that is just to ensure, like I say, if the worst happens, they're backed up, all their data is scattered in numerous places.
Yeah.
So if there's a ransomware attack that locks down their data, they should have copies of it somewhere else so they can just keep moving and keep their planes in the air and passengers and freight moving to and where it's got to go.
Yeah, because when planes are not in the air, that's a bad result for an airline.
There's been so much attention on kind of the airline industry at the moment for various economic reasons, various airlines shutting down, stuff like that. It was an appealing story, but that's why it won the VMworld Award as well.
Alex, you've been this week attending what sounds like a very interesting conference, maybe less corporate than many of the other things that we go to.
One of the least corporate conferences I've been to, with lots of really interesting people, really interesting speakers, a lot of activists, people from charities like Disability Rights UK. This was the launch of a new social inclusion hub and startup accelerator called Open Door, which is being run by Plexal, and they are startup hub in innovation centre located at Here East in Hackney, which is on the edge of the Olympic Park, or what was the Olympic Park, it's now the Queen Elizabeth Park. And after the Olympics were done, Plexal came along and got the government to give them a 200-year lease on the building that had been the TV broadcast centre, in which they, over the past few years, set up this massive hub. And the launch of the Social Inclusion Centre was really to, I guess, predicated on this need to expand the conversation around diversity in technology, which we pay so much attention to here at Computer Weekly, but to cover more groups and groups that you wouldn't necessarily think of as sort of in need of more inclusion. And you know, by bringing all these groups together in society, not only through technology, but it's about wider society as well, we can, you know, explore multiple benefits. And so it's bringing in conversations around inner city teens, refugees and recent immigrants, disabled people, like I mentioned. And it's not to diminish the need to cover topics that we focus on widely here at Computer Weekly, like women in tech. But a lot of the diversity coverage and that we do sort of centres the experiences of white middle class people. and there are other groups out there. So we heard from a guy called, I'm probably going to get this name horribly wrong, he's from Ethiopia, his name is Rezeni Ubolde Yesus, and he is deaf. He is a refugee who came to the UK a few years ago, and now he runs a company called Love Language, which is sort of inclusive services, advocacy for deaf people and so on. And he was talking about, you know, some of the challenges that he faces in engaging in society. There are 180,000 deaf people in the UK.
Yeah.
And about 980 sign language interpreters. So he was talking about the need for, you know, there is an absolute need for technology to take a role in
yeah.
teaching more people sign language,
mm.
In supporting accessibility features in programs such as Skype, which is shortly going to be able to do closed captioning
mm-hmm.
on video calls using AI.
Mm.
We also heard from Majeda Khoury, who runs a business called the Syrian Sunflower Kitchen, and she has a fantastic story. She was a human rights activist in Syria. She came here in 2016 via Lebanon. When she arrived in Britain, she didn't have a word of English. She self-taught herself by listening to audiobooks and Radio 4 for 10 hours a day. And she now runs a small catering business. She actually catered the lunch at this event, which was probably the best lunch I've ever eaten.
High praise. you
think you usually get soggy sandwiches,
yeah.
And disappointing little tapas things. But it was really nice sort of little Syrian specialities like stuffed courgettes. So she was talking a bit about, you know, the use of technology and language acquisition
mm-hmm.
for immigrants and refugees to the UK. We also heard from a government affairs manager at Microsoft, a guy called Tom Morrison Bell, who was talking about how a lot of innovation actually comes about as a result of accessibility.
Okay.
But think about your smartphone and the fact that you can now talk to it and it talks back to you.
Yes.
That was those features like that were developed. Who would make good use of that? Who would be a power user of a spoken search on a phone? It's a blind or partially sighted person.
Yeah.
And often you find that innovation centres challenges that you might not have thought about. That's why it's so important to get disabled people into
that's very into technology. Interesting.
Mm.
That's very interesting.
The Social Inclusion Unit, the SIU at Plexal, is looking for any and all groups to come forward. And it doesn't actually have to be about technology, it can be about lots of other things.
Mm.
Just to come forward and start shaping its agenda over the next few months. In September, they're going to be selecting 12 startup projects to move forward onto their Open Door Accelerator. We'll be developing more tech to increase social inclusion in the UK.
So switching gears completely, but staying with your good self, Alex. A few recent developments on the role of Huawei. Its results, I think, were pretty stellar announced this week.
Huawei made $107 billion in revenues last year, and there's not...
That puts it in a really exclusive club, doesn't it?
That's the god tier of technology businesses.
Yeah.
Alphabet, Google's parent, made $136 billion.
Mm.
Microsoft is $110
billion. Yeah.
And if you think about Huawei's main competitor globally, you'd probably pick out a Cisco, right?
Mm.
Yeah.
$49 billion last year. Ooh. Double the size of Cisco.
That's incredible, isn't it?
A lot of this growth for them is coming from the consumer business.
Mm.
Their smartphones are really flying off the shelves at the minute, particularly in developing markets because they're so cheap.
Mm.
And Huawei, in fact, hinted at the idea that the fact they are being talked about so much in a negative context, particularly in the West, is actually doing them a favour because it's increasing consumer awareness. People now are thinking about Huawei for their next smartphone purchase in a way they wouldn't before.
Oh, that's ironic.
Yeah, it's like the Streisand effect, isn't it?
Mm.
Mm.
Yeah, so keep talking about Huawei and maybe next year they'll be bigger than bigger than Microsoft.
The biggest general IT company possibly on the planet. It's it's such a big story, isn't it? The rise of China in this century. It's just incredible. Really, it certainly dwarfs Brexit as an issue.
Very much so, one we all need to be comrades of. And the political story around Huawei has leapt ahead as well.
Yeah.
We've had some very incendiary remarks from the US government about the possibility of threatening to cut off allies that continue to use Huawei, although That came from Mike Pompeo, who's the Secretary of State, who's a Trump loyalist, one might say. See, some of the people who are more intimately involved in United States intelligence are saying that they're actually trying to figure out ways of living with Huawei's presence in mobile networks, so cooler heads are probably going to prevail. And there was a report today in the UK as well that claimed that if we ban Huawei, which we might do, there would be a £6.8 billion impact on the British economy through the delay to 5G rollout.
That is amazing.
I think it's interesting though, because we talked about before when you were on the podcast about how Huawei was a little bit reticent about talking about any of the negative press around it, and they have opened up, so maybe they can see now that this is actually not the worst thing in the world, like in terms of from a numbers perspective, to maybe be a bit more open and be a bit more transparent.
I mean, they come out all guns blazing a lot, because nobody's yet bought any real evidence of malfeasance to the fore, and at the same time there's allegations flying around that the US is conducting surveillance on Huawei itself as well.
You have to look at the motivations in this case, and I think we're obviously Trump's got his big agenda that everyone buys American. Is this less of a surveillance concern and more of kind of a commercial interest, trying to keep himself in the kind of make America great again and all that?
I think a lot of it is stroking Trump's ego to some extent.
So I've been on my travels this week to Amsterdam, from which London took over. There is an alternative history where Amsterdam and not London would be the global switching centre for world finance, and it's still very, obviously very important city, Amsterdam. The reason I was there was for Infor's Inspire conference. Infor, who are they? They are a business applications software provider. They are a place that's home to a lot of older ERP systems. For example, Bands software has found a home there. But since 2010, they've been led by an ex-Oracle executive team. Charles Phillips is the CEO, kind of private equity backed. They made a massive bet on AWS. And going to the cloud and making AWS their partner for that. So they're very much on a kind of cloud journey. They're very verticalized, so they have ERPs for very kind of niche industries, fashion, brewing, steel, I mean, as many as you can think of, really. They're moving all of those to the cloud. Quite a lot of their revenue emerged at the conference comes from the cloud. It's kind of like 25% plus.
Okay, yeah.
My sense with SAP and Oracle over the last 4 or 5 years is it's gone from like 10 to roughly 20. And 50% of all new software is according to Charles Phillips, is cloud. I mean, you never entirely know with a private company, which is what they are.
Yeah.
And one of their things is, will they go for an IPO over the next year or so? If they do, it's going to be a very big IPO. The fact that they are private has allowed them to make a significant number of quite aggressive acquisitions that otherwise the financial analyst community might scrutinise.
Shareholders as well.
Yeah, exactly. So they've, for example, they acquired Burst, which is a cloud-based BI company that I used to know reasonably well. They acquired a thing called GT Nexus, company that does supply chain network stuff. Basically, they have all the acronyms. So they have ERP, ECM, supply chain management stuff. They have their own machine learning platform, as they all do, and they're all named after someone. This one's named after a lady who was at NASA, black woman scientist, Coleman. It's called Coleman. That kind of runs across everything that they do. Charles Phillips, in his keynote, made quite a, you know how they like to make kind of like a big picture pitch, and he was talking about the surprising lack of productivity both in Europe and America, despite all the technology that there is, and kind of, you know, rating, but saying nevertheless technology can be the answer to, has to be the answer really to the West increasing its productivity beyond 9% or whatever it is. In particular, he cited there business graph, which is a way of connecting up all the data from all their applications. Mm-hmm. So the data spewed out by all these applications goes into a data lake. There's the business graph so that customers can see things connected up and things like that. So that was his kind of big picture piece. My question for him, one of my first questions for him when we did an exec Q&A was the same question I put to Mark Hart of Oracle, at Oracle Open World, which was, so with SAP, you've got their customers moving or having to move really from ECC6 to S/4HANA, and that's a big undertaking for SAP customers, whether to do that or not. And whether he's seeing or their company is seeing defections from SAP because of that, because of the end of lifing of ECC6 and the new Vista of SAP HANA. He said yes, they were, but also defections from Oracle for similar sorts of reasons. One of their big pitches really around that is they just do applications. So they just do applications. They don't do database, they don't do cloud infrastructure, which comes from AWS. Yeah, so that means that all their R&D dollars can just go into the applications. They've got a chance of emerging because the two big companies here are Oracle and SAP. And they are one of the also-rans along with IFS and so on. You know, they do have quite a compelling story.
You talked about the possibility of an IPO. Is there any possibility that someone will try to buy them?
I suppose that could happen. Google, we might come on to this a bit later, but Google could emerge as an acquirer of... They need to acquire some business applications from somewhere.
Well, they have got the... Yeah, because they've got the productivity suite, but yeah, they haven't really... As, say, if you're lining up, say, Google versus Microsoft, for example, obviously they've got big plays in kind of... Yeah, they've got productivity, but yeah, they've got other back office stuff as well, and Google hasn't. So yeah, that could potentially be a match, I guess.
And Thomas Kurian is now in place at Google from Oracle.
Yes. Yeah, so he might just say, hey, hat tip, pick these guys up.
Well, that has to be something on his mind.
Yeah, absolutely.
And on his agenda, his acquisitions for Google.
I think that was one of the things that was talked about, was maybe they hadn't made enough acquisitions generally under their old leadership. So yeah, definitely could be a thing.
Okay, so that was me on Infor in Amsterdam. Earlier this week, attention was caught by the story about MI5 and the Met ramping up their use of data analytics in order to tackle terrorism. It's quite high profile at the beginning of the week. Essentially, this seems to go back to the terrorist attacks in 2017, you know, the Ariana Grande concert, the Manchester Arena, where Salman Abedi was responsible for the deaths of 22 people in that attack. And there was an Intelligence and Security Committee report towards the end of last year, basically saying that MI5 had been too slow. He had been one of the estimate, something like 20,000 subjects of interest who have been kind of put on a back burner. So many suspects to track MI5 and the Met. And so their response to that, their answer to the criticism that they were receiving towards the end of last year is to turn to technology and specifically data analytics. Although what this data analytics is, we can only really guess at, speculate upon what could be involved there. They're definitely building up they have to build up their capability in that. And it's about detecting signs that somebody who has been inactive, who they thought they can maybe park, is beginning to get active again. They might be visiting people who've just come out of prison, or, you know, all these kind of very subtle signs that someone should...
Because that is often the case, that as these stories emerge afterwards of the perpetrators of these atrocities, is that they were under surveillance, or they were being watched for a time, and then they've dropped off the radar for whatever reason. So yeah, so I guess finding sort of when does this person become someone to watch again, you know, looking for any, I guess, markers of that.
Yeah, and there's just so many of them.
Mm.
There is so many of them.
I do find it all quite disturbing in a way, in that it opens up conversations around what levels of surveillance are permissible,
absolutely.
And how technology
precisely.
You start getting into sci-fi dystopias and so on.
Mm.
But obviously it's important.
Well, this was an announcement that was jointly made this week by Andrew Parker, the Director General of Five, and Cressida Dick, Commissioner of the Metropolitan Police, and had a lot of profile on the BBC and things like that. The whole thing about predictive policing, I mean, there are vendors in BI and analytics space who can do some of that stuff off the shelf, but I should imagine they will be developing their own stuff. And we often say, or it is often said by politicians, that Britain is one of the world leaders in artificial intelligence and things like that. But when it comes to, say, the activity of GCHQ, I mean, we must be world class. And there's another story this week about GCHQ tapping into startup activity, isn't there? Alex?
This is also in Manchester, in fact, as a direct result of some of the things that have happened there. They've set up an accelerator that four startups have already gone through. This is being run alongside Telefonica's innovation arm, Wayra, and they're leaning on startups to find new and a cynical person like myself would say new and innovative ways of keeping a watchful eye on us. They describe it as pioneering a new kind of security. They took four startups through, as I said, one of which was doing 3D home modelling for control of smart home gadgets, one of whom was using a psychometrics to do sort of cultural fit during the recruitment process.
Okay.
Something you could see GCH, because GCHQ was one of those organisations that historically would tap people on the shoulders at Oxford and Cambridge and say, and then they turn out to be a Russian spy 10 years later, and then they have a more diverse and open recruitment policy that you can actually send them your CV.
Yeah.
But obviously you still have to be to be thoroughly vetted, so there's ways in there.
So, Caroline, we were talking there briefly about Thomas Kurian and his possible shopping list.
Yeah, he's been installed at Google Cloud as CEO for a little while now, since about the start of the year, I think it is. But so next week I'm at Google Cloud Next in San Francisco, which is going to be, I'm hoping, he'll give a bit of a state of the nation as to where Google Cloud's business is going and what his plans are for the business. He's spoken publicly already, saying that he's focused on aggressively taking Google Cloud into the enterprise. So I'm hoping there'll be a bit of a show and tell as to how he's actually going to do that. So he's taken over from a lady called Diane Greene, who, in terms of enterprise adoption of Google Cloud, her influence shouldn't be diminished either. That Google Cloud as a business has made great strides over the last year or so in terms of, winning hearts and minds of CIOs and stuff like that. So there's been a kind of gradual, as someone who tracks this stuff, a gradual evolution of Google as being maybe Google Cloud's technologies, maybe being something that people have as like, okay, we use AWS, but then we've got edge use cases where we bring in Google Cloud. So they're always more of a kind of a plus one vendor. When you talk to analysts, they'd be very kind of, they're kind of maybe second choice. Or next week we'll probably see a bit more from Thomas Kurian about how maybe he wants to go from plus one to make them the one for enterprises, is how what I'm hoping anyway. But no, it'll be interesting. I'm guessing there'll be more of a, if he's going after the enterprise, I'm guessing next week we'll probably hear a few more announcements around how they're making the platform kind of more enterprise friendly. It's probably got stuff about security. Every cloud conference like I've been to recently has had a big push around open source as well, so that people can move their applications and data with greater ease between different platforms as well. So
okay.
I'm anticipating probably a bit of open source chat as well. So it'd be good. It should be an interesting show. Yeah, let's just see what they've got to offer.
Where is it?
San Francisco at the Moscone Center. I think last year it was over both bits of it, so
it's been redeveloped.
Yeah, last year it was like a building site, walking between the different bits. Mm. So got my Fitbit on. It's always interesting to see how many steps you clock up at these shows, walking from one venue to the other.
Well, that's about all all we've got time for this week. I want to give a big shout out to Liz Evenstadt.
Liz is the management editor at Computer Weekly. She's off on maternity leave at the minute, but she was saying that the downtime upload is what she's been using as keeping her company during the night feeds and sleep deprivation. So yeah, shout out to Liz and baby Oliver.
And next week Claire is back, and it will be the debut on the podcast. Although she does appear elsewhere,
yeah,
in broadcast media, of Angelica Murray, who is covering government IT while Liz is away and listening to the podcast. And she's the author of many of our CIO interviews as a freelance before joining the team. Okay, so it just remains for me to say thank you to Caroline, thank you to Alex, and thank you for listening. Bye.
Bye.
Bye.